This is DomesticPreparedness.com. Since 1998, Domestic Preparedness has been a source of solutions for the professional preparedness community. Your host today is the managing editor, John Morton.
This podcast interview is sponsored by TVI Corporation. Mobility, Protection, Response. TVI Corporation is the manufacturer of rapid deploy shelter systems, solutions for decontamination, isolation infection control, surge capacity, plus command control. For more information, visit www.tvicorp.com.
Domestic Preparedness is at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. We are with Dr. Michael Carrillo, who is the Director of the Office of Biodefense Research Affairs and the Associate Director for the Biodefense Product Development within NIH's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Since 2001, NIAID has launched several new biodefense research initiatives to catalyze development of vaccines, therapies, and diagnostic tests. Dr. Carrillo, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
All right. First of all, for our first segment, I want to start with biodefense. If you would, can you give us an overview of NIAID's role in biodefense in this country today?
Well, NIAID, or NIAID, sees three broad areas that we are engaged with in biodefense. First and foremost, which is in concert with NIH's traditional basic science role, we are focused on an expansion of the basic science research and knowledge and information regarding these pathogens. Largely, a lot of what we know is based on historical data that has been derived at a time when prior scientific sophistication is not as advanced as it is today, and we're filling in a lot of gaps and holes in the knowledge space. Secondly, we are engaged overall within product development, fostering product development for infectious disease and public health applications. And as we've seen with the recent anthrax incident, the utilization of ciprofloxacin, which is a commercially available antibiotic, plays an important role. We are seeking to advance the armamentarium in infectious diseases to address these agents, as well as broad public health infectious disease concerns. And finally, since the biodefense pathogens do present some unique issues, we are focused on novel and innovative targeted interventions for both vaccines as well as therapeutics, and then corresponding diagnostics to support their use that address specific high-consequence pathogens for which the intelligence community tells us we should be paying particular attention to.
Well, let's look a little bit at what you just said there on the real threats. I know that you have research priorities and goals for each microorganism that might be used as an agent of bioterrorism. And the particular emphasis is on the category A agents, those considered by CDC to be the worst bioterror threats. Now, how far along are you in realizing your priorities and goals in this area?
Well, we have made significant progress, and in a recent evaluation of our immediate goals, we have found that we have, in fact, addressed every immediate goal that had been identified. Now, in terms of fully satisfying those goals, we feel that we have done as much as we need to do at this point, insofar as that as the work has progressed, we have found that the attention and focus has evolved away from the initial analysis. So we feel that we're making very good progress in terms of not only addressing the immediate pathogens on the Category A threat list, but also laying down an infrastructure that is responsive not only to the Category A agents, but provide us flexibility to work with those on Category B and C, as well as any new agents that may appear in the future.
Mm-hmm. And just give us a, you know, for those that might not know, a list, a short list of your categories. I mean, you're talking tularemia.
We're talking tularemia. We're talking botulism. We're talking anthrax, plague, and the smallpox and viral hemorrhagic fevers such as Ebola, mm-hmm. Marburg.
Now, turning to the construction of what are called the National Biocontainment Laboratories, NIAID supports the construction efforts, and my understanding is that these labs include facilities built to the biosafety level 4 standards, and they're to be capable of safely containing any pathogen. You have 9 regional labs at the biosafety level 3 facilities that planned are already in construction. Can you tell us about these efforts in detail?
Well, we actually have 13 regional biosafety containment laboratories. There were 9 that were awards were made in 2003. We made an additional 4 awards in 2005. Okay. And then there are 2 national biosafety containment laboratories, the BSL-4s. As we did an analysis based on anticipated budgets as well as the extent of research efforts that we felt was likely to be created as a result of that funding, a estimate based on the amount of containment facilities that would be expected to be required to support that work. And it became clear that a construction of new facilities was going to be necessary in order to allow the extent of the funded research that we anticipated supporting to be conducted in the safest manner feasible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I'm particularly interested in the 10 regional centers of excellence for biodefense and emerging and infectious diseases research. Now, my understanding here is that there are academic centers which will develop the human infrastructure for biodefense research. Is that right?
Essentially, that's correct. They are actually consortia, which means they are groups of academic centers that bring together a wide array of academic disciplines in an interdisciplinary and multidisciplinary approach to taking fresh looks at a lot of these major issues and coming up with novel and innovative creative concepts that will generate future products. The level of support allows them to maintain adequate core facilities to be able to fully and sufficiently and rigorously scientifically vet the concepts that are put forth that will lead to the development of new products. And the interdisciplinary nature of this effort is really critical when you start down a product development path.
Well, I think people might be wondering, well, what connection does this have with the public health agencies? Well, my understanding is these centers are going to partner, if they haven't already, with the state and local public health agencies for coordinated response to a bio-incident or, indeed, a pandemic. Can you go into some detail about that?
That is correct. A component of the centers is that they have an emergency response plan and that they develop coordination with their local and state public health groups and emergency preparedness groups. At the lowest level of involvement is the ability to very rapidly engage the appropriate scientific expertise when issues arise. We saw a very good example of this during the Hurricane Katrina aftermath, where in a matter of less than 48 hours, we were able to very rapidly, utilizing the regional centers of excellence, assemble a team of in excess of 200 infectious disease experts, mm-hmm. who were able to address all sorts of issues that were arising in the aftermath of Katrina that had a lot of local emergency workers concerned about potential problems that could arise.
Now, did they come from a number of the centers?
They came from all 10 of the centers.
So it's like a strike force.
Like a strike force, yes.
Where are the centers, by the way?
As I said, they are consortia. So one individual center may have anywhere from 10 to as many as 25 different academic institutions. Each center, though, has a host institution. They are regionally distributed. So there's one located in Boston. There's one in New York. There's one here in Maryland, mm-hmm. In North Carolina, in Chicago, St. Louis, Seattle, Colorado and California and Texas. I don't know if I've hit all 10. And New Jersey. Yes, there we go.
In the sense of, a state in that example that may not be, may not have a regional center, if they wanted to get more information or if they felt they needed to generate from the bottom up a requirement that would include the capability that a regional center would offer, is there a process for that, or is that how things are working? Can you give us a little background? If I'm a local or a state-level guy or gal out there, and I want to know more about what you're able to provide, and then put that into my response plan, can you tell us a little bit about how that would
work? Yeah, I would. Yeah, if that were the situation, I would contact my state or local response official, who would be tied in with their regional partners in that, and one of those regional partners would be located within a state that did have an RCE location, and that's where the connection would come from. NIAID is not directing that specifically, but we are requiring that the RCEs do develop and actively engage their state and local emergency preparedness capabilities with their state and local authorities.
Great. In this second segment, let's now turn to biodefense vaccine development. In September 2001, the U.S. had 15.4 million doses of smallpox vaccine available. And Dr. Fauci, your NIAID director, has said we now have more than 300 million doses. Perhaps the total is even higher. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the U.S. government did have 15.4 million doses of the previous Dryvax vaccine that was used successfully in the worldwide eradication of smallpox. NIAID undertook a dilutional study and determined that vaccine could be diluted 1 to 5 safely and still retain sufficient potency to generate protective immunity in individuals. In addition, as a consequence of the desire for more smallpox vaccine, pharmaceutical companies that had been engaged previously decades ago in making smallpox vaccine were able to identify within their warehouses additional vaccine that had been not inventoried previously. And so we were able to get access to that and test it for potency and evaluate it. And that has allowed us to make the claim that we can supply the entire country with adequate levels of vaccine at this point.
Now, in terms of the next generation smallpox vaccine, that's modified Vaccinia Ankara. It's in clinical testing?
The MVA is in clinical testing. There is one other vaccine that is moving towards licensure, and that is a more modern version of the original Dryvax vaccine, which has been produced by a company in England, a tissue culture-derived version of Dryvax. That is headed towards full licensure and will be available. MVA, the modified Vaccinia Ankara, was a response that NIAID had bring forward availability a smallpox vaccine that would be safe for immunocompromised populations to use. In addition, one of the original contraindications for Dryvax had been for individuals with atopic dermatitis because of the method of delivery of the vaccine. People with atopic dermatitis are precluded from getting that. And so when you include the immunocompromised, the atopic dermatitis population, and their household contacts, you end up with a number somewhere in the range of about 50 to 60, perhaps as high as 70 million Americans who you would prefer not to give the traditional vaccine to. So the MVA is a rather novel, innovative vaccine concept because it's a live virus, but it does not replicate within people, and so it is safe for an immunocompromised population to take. That is in advanced clinical testing. It's in phase 2 clinical trials at the moment, and We can certainly, at this point in time, say that we have not seen anything in the development to suggest that it will not move forward towards licensure.
Have you got other vaccines under preclinical development?
We have a number of additional smallpox vaccines that have come out of our research base that are at various stages of within preclinical development, with the goal of making an even safer vaccine that would be available to the general population.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the new oral form of the antiviral drug? It's
Cidofovir.
Cidofovir.
We actually have two smallpox drugs. The oral form of cidofovir, also known as HDP cidofovir, as well as another small molecule called ST-246. Both of those are in clinical development right now. And both of them show very good activity on smallpox. We anticipate that with licensure of those drugs, we would have the capability to address not only individuals who actually come down with clinical smallpox if there were an outbreak, but also any individual who would have an adverse effect from the vaccine. Mm-hmm. The addition of the therapeutic would modulate those complications.
Let's look at anthrax. NIAID has aggressively pursued a new vaccine called RPA. HHS has contracted with Vaxgen to purchase, I think, 75 million doses under BioShield. Now, tell us where we are with this program.
Well, this program is proceeding along. RPA, or recombinant protective antigen, is a second-generation anthrax vaccine, and we feel that this is a much safer version relative to the currently licensed AVA vaccine. Right now, NIAID is supporting two developers, both Vaxgen and another company called Avisha, to develop this vaccine. Both of those companies have their RPA vaccines in phase two trials, and those contracts are proceeding quite satisfactory.
Yeah, do you have other new anthrax therapies underway as well?
We have a number of anthrax therapeutics that are being evaluated at various states in both preclinical and clinical development, including monoclonal antibodies, polyclonal antibodies, as well as a few small molecule inhibitors of the anthrax toxin.
Now, how about botulism? You have in development antibody treatments for the toxin that causes it, as well as a new vaccine to prevent the disease. What can you say about those?
We have a number of different vaccine initiatives at various stages. Both NIAID as well as DOD are aggressively pursuing botulism vaccines. In addition, the Department, Health and Human Services, is moving forward with an equine antitoxin that would cover all seven serotypes of botulism. The currently available equine antitoxin that would be used by the CDC in cases of botulism is limited to only serotype A and B. So the equine heptavalent will be a valuable addition. Furthermore, NIAID is supporting some rather novel, innovative concepts. We have a monoclonal antibody program that is in preclinical manufacturing process right now, looking at a cocktail of monoclonal antibodies against botulism A, mm-hmm. and we have coming behind still in the research base monoclonals that would address both B and E at this point. An ABE monoclonal antibody cocktail would address perhaps 97% of all foodborne botulism that occurs in this country.
Now, for Ebola, you have a promising vaccine in human clinical trials at the at your vaccine research center. What can you say about that?
That is an intramural program, and that that is at the Vaccine Research Center, which is managed by Gary Nabels. And they produced an Ebola vaccine that has been tested through phase one, and the limited data that is available at phase one, because it's primarily for safety, does in fact show some immunogenicity of the vaccine. They are continuing development of vaccine. At the same time, My office is working towards the development of animal models for Ebola that would be in support of licensure for either a vaccine or a therapeutic. And we are hoping to advance a Ebola therapeutic as well, mm-hmm. in addition to the vaccine.
Now, NIAID has had clinical trials for the flu vaccine supply and the biodefense contracts for vaccine development. What can you say about those?
Well, flu continues to be a major concern and issue, not only the pandemic, but also the seasonal flu. And so in response to the pandemic vaccine, NIAID has contracted for development of various vaccine formulations for the avian flu vaccine, mm-hmm. and has conducted a number of clinical trials that have been able to demonstrate safety as well as immunogenicity of those vaccines, and is in the process of initiating clinical trials dealing with special populations of particular note to the flu, which includes the elderly as well as the pediatric population.
Mm-hmm. In this last segment, I want to talk about a couple of issues. First, on treatments for radiological or nuclear exposure. NIAID made 5 BioShield awards in September that totaled $4 million to fund the development of products to eliminate radioactive materials from the human body following any radiological or nuclear exposure. Tell us a little bit about what exactly you're looking for here.
Those awards were primarily in the area of early phase research to identify novel and innovative concepts for the treatment of radiological and nuclear exposure. In addition, towards that end, we have funded a number of centers akin to the Regional Centers of Excellence for Biodefense that also address the radiological and nuclear countermeasures. And finally, there is a major focus that is looking at better what would be called diagnostics for radiological and nuclear exposure, which is better dosimetry, that is to rely on merely one point in time assessment rather than the cumbersome types of methodologies that we have today that would not be very convenient in the event of a large scale radiological or nuclear event.
That's interesting. The dosimetry, would these be sort of very miniaturized?
They are all types of methodology. Some are large devices that people would stand in for a period of time. Mm-hmm. Others involve being able to assess things like teeth without having to remove them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now the centers that you're funding, how many of those are do you have?
I believe there are 4.
Okay. Are they across the nation?
They are across the nation. They are covered by a different division within NIAID, mm-hmm. who does the NUCRAD.
Now, as far as the treatments, how do you see them being deployed? Would they be directly to households, like the prepositioning of potassium iodide thyroid treatments to homes around nuclear power plants, or you have a thought on that?
Yeah, deployment is a very tricky area. We refer to that as CONOPS, as a concept mm-hmm. of operations, as to how a countermeasure would actually be utilized. And unfortunately, that is not NIAID's mm-hmm. main forte, and it's not our responsibility. Those deployment of those countermeasures that are within the stockpile fall under the purview of the CDC mm-hmm. because the CDC manages the stockpile. So they actually determine the exact mechanisms and parameters regarding the deployment. We work very closely with the CDC, however, because what we found is that many of the inherent deficiencies in particular countermeasures are tied directly to their capability for efficient deployment. Yeah. So it actually works the other way. The CDC tells us the best way that things could be deployed, and then we structure our programs so that the countermeasures will address that mm-hmm. deployment component as well as the safety and efficacy of the countermeasure itself.
Yeah, that's what I was getting to, actually, is that how the deployment options inform the kinds of research and the kinds of treatments that you'd be looking at.
There's a dialogue and a back and forth. And the best example I could give to that, an initiative that we recently just closed, it's under review right now, which is for third-generation anthrax vaccine. The features that distinguish the third generation from the second generation are primarily issues that impact deployment of the vaccine in the most efficient manner possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, this has been great, Dr. Perla. Thanks very much for letting us be with you today. Many thanks, and thanks as well for your service to our country.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This has been a Domestic Preparedness podcast interview.